Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. Summer's fading here in the rearview mirrors, and we're approaching fall. We're starting going from the cooling season to the heating season. And with that, maybe a little uptick in the kinds of runs that we're all going to be taking in here in the next three, four weeks in anticipation of what's going to happen once the old white stuff starts falling in at least certain parts of the country. And today's rundown, we're going to start out with Brother Mike's going to talk about some recent accidents, and we unfortunately have not been lacking with those, both with apparatus and some ambulance accidents. We're going to talk about, in regard to that, response policies that the departments are operating under, or some departments, including larger organizations, are considering. And then we're going to go into some specifics, talking about one of Brother Mike's favorite kinds of fire trucks, be it six-tired, eight-tired, 10, or even those that bend in the middle. We're going to be talking about how to determine horizontal reach for buildings in your area, and talk about some of the manufacturers that build longer horizontal reach aerials for your consideration. And then we're going to wrap up with a couple of questions that have come in from our listeners here in the last several weeks. So starting out with Brother Mike, don't always like to start out on a down note here, but I know there's been no shortage of accidents out there. What do you have for us and your analysis on those?
Thank you, Brother Tom, and good afternoon, everybody. We start out October. We are taping this in October, and we start out October on really a down note, a couple of kind of minor events that go on all the time. The first is a backing incident on October the 9th, and this was submitted as a close call, and we want to thank the folks from this department for doing that. It was about 1,400 hours. The crew at one of our stations was backing the engine into the bay, which was narrow for the equipment stored there at the station. Following department SOPs, one of the firefighters was behind the engine on the driver's side as a backer guide person trying to guide the driver into the bay. When the firefighter noticed the station was about to be hit, he stepped out from between the corner of the station and the fire apparatus, and in turn got his head pinned between the fire truck and the station. The driver was not able to see his backer due to the glare of the sun. Luckily, had his window rolled down and heard the firefighter scream for him to stop. The firefighter did not suffer serious injuries, but only minor cuts, swelling, and a really bad headache. This could have been certainly a lot worse. If our listeners would go to Firehouse Magazine in November, I wrote another backing article. And in it, it shows what I had never seen before, and maybe you have, Brother Tom, I don't know, but there was a something aerial tower where they had headsets, and the driver had a headset, and the backer had a headset, and there was actually a plug in the rear of the apparatus on the driver's side where they could plug their headset in and have direct voice communication with the driver, between the driver and the spotter. And then one of the firefighters there said, "Oh, that's nothing. You should see right next to us. They have a wireless set of headphones where the driver and the backer or spotter can talk to each other and get the apparatus backed in safely." So that is in the November issue of Firehouse Magazine. And Brother Tom, have you ever seen or heard anything like that?
I've seen it being demonstrated, Mike, but I am familiar with that and have seen that in departments where I've happened to be visiting, with both the wired as well as the newer style of the wireless. And whether it's that or some of the other devices that we've talked about previously, I think one of the most important things for our listeners to gain in anticipation of Brother Mike's article upcoming is to have a standardized policy and to be able to actually practice and train that to reinforce it. When we've heard about apparatus over the course of the last several years of apparatus backing over our own personnel, backing over civilians, there was that famous YouTube video that was posted up back about, you know, early summer, showing a tanker with the backup alarm. You could clearly hear it in the background, and it actually backs in to a civilian that is kind of like in a fog, and he's walking behind the apparatus. But it just seems to me, Mike, that no matter what the level of technology that's available out there, when we eventually go to embrace the technology, more often than not, it's after we've had a near miss, a close call, or maybe a tragedy. And it just brings to mind where we talk about, and this is going to weave into very shortly here into another story that Mike's going to talk about somebody falling out of a fire truck, is we maybe take a little bit too much for granted in that people say, well, we're going to back up and we're going to supply a backer. And they say, well, we're going to ride out and we need to make sure everybody puts their seatbelt on. Well, do we really practice that? Is it something that is enforced? And every one of these incidents to me, Mike, seem to have a unfortunate reoccurring theme, is that there was a semblance of a policy, you know, people kind of knew better, or they admitted that, you know, there was maybe some technology available there that they didn't completely embrace or employ, and the results are, unfortunately, time and time again, are pretty reliable, that these kinds of bad things just keep happening.
Yeah, absolutely, Brother Tom. And you're right, it brings us to the next story. And we go to Prince George's County in Maryland, where I happen to be this weekend, and actually happen to be listening to the radio when this particular event took place. A 20-year volunteer firefighter from Chapel Oak Station in Prince George's fell out of a reserve Seagrave engine on the way to a report of a house fire. It was went on to be reported that a similar incident occurred on January 21st in 08 with door latches on an older model Seagrave engine used as the reserve unit. And in that case, it was in a Bladensburg of VFD where a firefighter fell out of a 1989 PGFD reserve Seagrave during that incident. And I like what Chief Goldfeder said in Firefighters Close Calls, and I absolutely agree with him. You know, you can blame this, you can blame that, you can blame door latches, you can blame whatever, but the blame really lies on the firefighter being accountable for his or her own personal safety and putting a seatbelt on. Regardless of whether this thing even had a door or not, would have been immaterial had the firefighter had a seatbelt on and been buckled in. Irrelevant whether the door latch was good, bad, or indifferent, had he or she been belted in. It's unfortunate. Luckily, later on that night, after the class that I was giving, it was learned from a paramedic supervisor that although the firefighter was taken to Prince George's County Trauma Unit, the injuries were considered non-life-threatening and fairly minor, with just a really bad case of road rash. We move on now to just a series of catastrophes where a half a dozen civilians have been killed since the first of the month in October. On Monday, October 4th in Los Angeles, a man with DUI was killed when he slammed into a stopped, blocking, properly positioned Los Angeles County Fire Department engine on the 105 freeway. A 2011 Toyota slammed right into the back of the engine that had stopped. And we've said this often in both this broadcast and in the column in Firehouse Magazine and wherever we teach, that a lot of times red lights, an overabundance of red lights, tend to draw in drunk, drugged, and fatigued drivers and make us much more of a target than if we had amber lights or clear lights or reduced lighting. Chief Brunicini in Phoenix found the value in this years and years ago, and the Phoenix Fire Department put out an excellent video about reduced lighting at accident scenes to prevent or at least diminish the chances of a drunk, drugged, and fatigued driver from running into the apparatus. And in Edmonton, Canada, a fiery crash near Valley View did so much damage to one vehicle that the police couldn't tell what the vehicle was or how many people were even killed. It crashed into an oil field apparatus. The two vehicles struck each other head-on at about 7 o'clock in the morning. The firefighter was driving a 5-ton cube van outfitted with firefighting equipment. He survived the crash as he was forced to cut himself out of a seatbelt to get out of the wreck. Lucky to have been in shape to be able to cut himself out. He was not hurt, but due to the severity of the crash and the subsequent fire, police were still unable to confirm the vehicle type and number of occupants connected to the second vehicle that remains unknown as we do this broadcast. A fatal or rescue crash in Michigan on October 4th. A rescue unit was responding to a deadly accident in Montcalm County and was involved in a second, also fatal crash late Monday morning. This rescue unit was headed north on West County Line Road with its lights and sirens when it collided with an eastbound car. According to the preliminary reports, the passenger in the civilian car died instantly. She was a 61-year-old woman. The driver of the car, 64, was listed in critical condition. The driver of the rescue unit was taken by ambulance to Grand Rapids Hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. The rescue unit had a stop sign, and the eastbound car did not, and authorities believe that the rescue driver failed to yield at the intersection stop sign, hitting the other vehicle broadside, and the county prosecutor's office will review this crash to determine if charges are going to be issued. Sunday, October 10th, another fatal EMS crash in Illinois claimed the life of a 52-year-old and a 45-year-old in West Union. They were driving an ambulance along Route 1 outside of the city. He was transporting a patient and another EMT when officials said a pickup truck entering from a side street slammed right into the ambulance. Both the patient and the EMT were thrown from the vehicle. The driver was transported to the hospital, or the driver of the civilian auto was transported to the hospital where she was pronounced dead. A second person in the pickup truck also had to be airlifted to an area hospital. That person's condition is unknown. A fatal ambulance crash in Philadelphia on October 9th. This morning in Philadelphia, an ambulance was involved in a fatal crash. A car slammed into the ambulance and burst into flames. The civilian driver of the car was killed. The patient and a medic in the back were injured, and the medic in the front driving the ambulance was also injured. And you, there's a picture on our website, emergencyvehiclerespondse.com, as well as firefighters' close calls, and you can see not much left of that particular automobile. A fatal apparatus crash in California, and again, there is actually video on the website of this crash. It happened at 20:02 hours on Friday, October 8th, in Kern County, California, a place that Brother Tom and I frequent. It's on the border with L.A. County, out by Edwards Air Force Base. They were responding to a vehicle crash involving one of Kern County's own department ladder trucks. The crew of Truck 41 from Virginia Colony provided immediate assistance to the victims of this accident. Upon arrival, additional crews was faced with a vehicle that had struck the ladder truck head-on traveling on Highway 178. The ladder truck, which is based in East Bakersfield, was returning, not responding, from a previous incident in Kern Canyon heading westbound when the crash occurred. Two persons in the car were declared deceased by the paramedics on scene. No injuries were sustained to the firefighters in the ladder truck. And again, there are pictures and video available of that on the websites. And the car was just basically in pieces. You needed to pick it up and put it in a thimble. There was just little left after they hit this rear-mounted tower ladder head-on. Just a gruesome, grisly scene. And that's it on the wrecks for this month, Brother Tom.
Well, Mike, I guess the initial takeaway I have from what you just described is, you know, whether in the case, unfortunate, you know, all of these cases unfortunate, and certainly where there's fatalities involved, just, you know, tragic beyond putting anything reasonably into words, but whether you're returning from an alarm in the case of Kern County, and when you investigate that a little bit more, you find out that it's the apparatus is traveling at a reasonable rate of speed, returning from the alarm. It's on a very narrow, winding portion of the highway, and you just frankly can never let your guard down. You take the situation in Prince George's County, and again, while that's every one of these incidents are tragic and somewhat difficult to fathom, and my takeaway there is you have a young man who's willing to go volunteer his time. Whether he was properly trained or not is up to supposition in terms of when you say we want you to be seated and put your seatbelt on, it's no different from scenarios that Mike and I have seen when we're out sometimes doing hands-on training and with no pressure, with no incident actually going on, you ask somebody to, climb up on a fire truck to do something, and you watch the way they climb on the apparatus, and you sit there and you just want to scratch your head and say, who the heck trained him or her how to get on and off the fire truck? It's really basic stuff, but sometimes you just wonder, do we take too much for granted when we say we're going to back up the fire truck and we need a backer? Has anybody trained the person how to do that? If we say we're going to get on the fire truck to go out to go, do a drill, and you would hope that people would know how to get on and off a fire truck, how to sit and how to put their seatbelt on, you really wonder sometimes, even though it may be written, and people say, oh, it's in the general orders. I think more often than not, Mike and I, unfortunately, have heard people, come back with something saying, well, there's a regulation out on that, or it's in the general orders, and then you say, well, when was the last time somebody broke out the good book, the general orders, and really looked at everything, or more importantly, prior to something bad happening, people, will always go defer to try to shift blame sometimes and say, well, the guy didn't follow the general orders. Well, maybe nobody really imparted all that knowledge on him and what it was supposed to be. So at any rate, moving on from that, Mike, that kind of takes us into our topic number two, talking about response policies. And I know that's something you've had a lot of work that you've done both inside and outside your occupation with FDNY. What insights can you supply here recently of what's been going on with people wanting to look at and maybe review and change up their existing response protocols?
Well, Brother Tom, I am very proud to report that Fire Commissioner Sal Cassano from the FDNY announced earlier this month that we in the FDNY are going to start a pilot program in the borough of Queens for a reduced red light and siren response to non-emergent conditions that we go to. I think, and even in his words, and I believe it's been a long time coming, our emergencies have gone up dramatically over time, and our fire load has decreased dramatically over the course of my 30-year career, and we still continue to wreck any number of fire trucks. The calls for non-life-threatening calls and emergencies are going to reach around 230,000 this year, and this was an increase from 41,000 back in 1969, the beginning of what many would call the burn baby burn days, where inner cities with riots and other kinds of civil unrest and arson plagues burnt for about 20 years from 68 to 88 or thereabouts, depending on who you talk to. Nearly 700 times last year it was reported that FDNY fire trucks collided with other vehicles, and even occasionally, yes, with one another. And so for the first time, the FDNY is re-engineering its approach. It plans to begin on Monday in Queens. It's meant to slow firefighters' response to certain calls by having them turn off their lights and sirens and follow the usual rules of the road. In 2009, there were 148 accidents involving fire trucks that were responding to calls for things like water leaks and gas leaks, toppled trees, foul odors, false alarms, and faulty sprinkler activations. In October, it was well documented last October that a ladder truck flipped over and skidded into a tree after colliding with an engine company racing to the same non-fire emergency in the borough of Brooklyn, pinning the driver in the wreckage and injuring more than a dozen people. And Commissioner Cassano said the idea to alter the protocols first took root with him in the 90s when he was a division commander in Brooklyn and saw a civilian killed after a fire truck was racing to a minor event and crashed in the street. He too, like I agree, it's just a policy change that's long overdue. Often, responding to a call can be even more dangerous for our members than the incident itself, the fire commissioner said. We want to minimize the danger this poses to firefighters and to the public. All other emergency responses will still apply for, you know, fire calls and serious medical calls. But in two other areas, the Department Bureau of Operations will instruct firefighters to modify the response, a move that runs counter to our longstanding gung-ho culture. And Commissioner Cassano and Chief Kilduff and Chief of Operations Bob Sweeney have worked tirelessly, along with the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, to really put the FDNY at the forefront of what I believe is occurring right now in this country, and that is just a cultural shift where we as firefighters are going to change the way that we drive and deliver the services that we deliver. And this need for change is not based on the fact of just change itself, but rather what we've been doing the past few years just hasn't worked very well for us.
Well, Mike, specifically on what types of incidents with this pilot program that FDNY is going to embark on, what type of incidents are going to qualify for this reduced response? And I guess reduced response doesn't mean fewer units, but only some of the assignment is going to go red lights and siren or code 3 if you're on the West Coast. And exactly what type of incidents are going to qualify for that response? And it always seems to me that irrespective of the size of the organization, when you go to make a policy change like this, that it's almost like we're changing the culture here. And as Mike and I have seen in a lot of organizations where the response to bona fide emergency incidents, or specifically because structural fires, is so small that we tend to almost kind of get in this fog that, okay, so we're going out on another EMS call or whatever, and it just seems to be routine, if not almost like we're somewhat in a state of a stupor going through this. So when the tones go out or however we're alerted, and the information supplied by the dispatcher indicates that it is anything to do with a structural fire, it's then, I mean, everything gets heightened in some cases overly so. So what types of alarms are actually going to have this type of response?
The few that I've been privy to so far are gas leaks, toppled trees, alarm system activations, water leaks. A more a better, more comprehensive list we'll probably have on the program next month. But the commissioner went on to say that not only is he going to re-engineer the response policies for the FDNY, but he is also planned to apply his new protocols to some aspects of the EMS medical service for the city of New York. 850,000 of its 1.3 million calls for service last year, almost two-thirds were for situations that were just simply not life-threatening emergencies. The commissioner said that he recalled in his history when the fires and false alarms made up overwhelming majority of calls, but he said, and I quote, it's a different world out there now. And through last month, Brother Tom, there were 19,379 calls for structural fires this year, 14,556 for other fires, and there were 160,739 medical calls, and then there were 162,812 non-medical and non-fire calls. So even this year, the beat continues on, and we continue to go out to more non-emergency responses. And finally, the fire commissioner, much to his credit, has decided to act and make those non-emergency responses non-emergency responses. And this is a trial period in the borough of Queens that's going to go on for 3 months, and then it's going to be reevaluated, potentially tweaked, and then instituted citywide.
Well, very interesting to me, Mike, that a department and an organization as large as the city of New York is going to basically tackle and take on this particular issue head on. And you have written quite a bit, and we've spoken in the past, going back to organizations like the St. Louis Fire Department that for a good number of years has had response policies where they respond, and I think the local terminology was called on the quiet. It's interesting as you travel around to talk to departments to find out what not only their activity levels are, but what their response protocols happen to be, that it's pretty interesting. And you take to the departments in the eastern portion of the United States or in many areas where in the larger, heavily built-up areas, the stations were built of necessity rather close to one another. So there's a distinct difference in operational characteristics of whether you're first due or second due ladder company or first, second, third, or fourth due engine. And depending upon your order of arrival, that automatically keys off certain procedures that are routinely going to be done by those companies, again, based upon the number of units, total number of units responding in their order of arrival. I recently returned from a very nice vacation where with my wife went out to Hawaii and visited several stations with the Federal Fire Department on the island of Oahu, and then six or seven stations out in Maui County. And there it was very, very evident, particularly out in Maui, where because of the distances involved with the stations, unlike what we have here in the East Coast, you know, response time is critical throughout, but if you were 30 or 45 seconds late leaving the station, other than having an impact on the arrival of the first due company, you really don't have to worry about getting beat. In Maui County, there was a total, I think, on the island of Maui itself, there are 10 fire stations, and many of the stations are easily 6, 7, 8 miles apart. So the response time for your second due company, it's not measured in seconds, it's measured in minutes. So the response of the initial arrival of the first due station, you don't necessarily have to worry about, like you do, Mike, in the Bronx, of worry about getting beat in if you're out of position or you're out doing building inspections and you're responding and you're coming from the far end of the district. There, it was very, very dramatic. The distance between stations, and the fact that on the main island of Maui, they had 10 engine companies and just two ladder companies to protect arguably a pretty low-rise community, with few exceptions, but the distances and the travel distances involved with the stations were just incredible. But still, if you don't have a policy, it's probably incumbent upon your community to think about what you're doing and to kind of carefully analyze your operation. So with that, we're going to take a quick break and come back. It's Mike Wilver and Tom Shan, the apparatus architects, and we're going to come back talking a little bit more about this, the response policies to finish up, and then we're going to be talking about aerial apparatus and horizontal reach. So we'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hey, we're back. It's the apparatus architects, Mike Wilver and Tom Shand, and just to finish up our commentary and discussion this month talking about response policies, just word for our listeners, if your department has a response policy, it probably is worthwhile for you to blow the dust off that, find out what section it is in the department's general orders, and maybe plan a training session to reinforce the important points that are outlined in that policy. Whether it has to do with the responsibility of the companies based on order of arrival, what the responsibilities of the companies are once they get there based on order of arrival, and the type of building or the type of construction, and to make sure that everybody is, as they say, singing off the same sheet of music with respect to that. Most importantly, if your department doesn't have a policy or the policy has kind of fallen by the wayside and people are not really paying attention to it, it might be time again to have the department officials responsible for that, whether it's the people in operations or training or a combination, however your department happens to operate, to make sure that everybody understands what the guidelines and the rules and regulations are. I think the only worst thing to having a policy that people don't pay attention to or ignore is not having a policy at all and just letting people kind of do whatever they want. Hopefully there's not too many organizations that fall under that umbrella, but if you do, words to the wise, as they would say. So now we're going to shift gears up and talk a little bit about the favorite kind of devices that Brother Mike has the opportunity to work on, and that's aerial ladders. As much as it pains me as an engine guy to not talk about hose and nozzles this month, then so be it. We're going to put that on the shelf. And we're going to talk about why horizontal reach is important. So, Mike, can you speak a little bit about me being a guy, my horizontal reach is just looking at what the longest attack line that I got to pull or pull the leader line to get in to climb over you ladder guys. But why is horizontal reach important, and how do you kind of measure that?
Okay. First and foremost, one of the questions, Tom, that I ask classes when I do my aerial and tower ladders operation and placement class is, what configuration do you use your aerial ladder or tower ladder most? Do you use it more in a vertical plane or a horizontal plane? And if you think about it, without a doubt, if you are in somewhere other than a major city like Philadelphia or Baltimore or New York or Los Angeles City, you are using your aerial device in more of a horizontal plane to reach than rather a vertical plane for the so-called high-rise or mid-rise building that may be in your first do. With that said, one of the things that we do in class on day two that I kind of figured out to do is to take each truck and measure it. And we take a tape measure out, and the first thing that we determine is what the operational footprint of the vehicle actually is. In other words, how much room does it really need to set up? And so what we do, we'll take, and I will instruct the operator, take the aerial device and put it at a 90-degree angle to the chassis at 0 degrees elevation. And without obviously putting the aerial device out, this is as much room as the unit will take up on the street in a non-extended position. And I coined it, and maybe others have as well, but I call that the operational footprint of the vehicle. And each vehicle has potentially a different operational footprint. Why is that important to know? We went and did an apparatus needs assessment for a community in Oregon, and everybody there was just hot to trot with buying a rear-mounted tower until I told them that most rear-mounted towers, the measurement from the tip of the aerial back to the chassis or the tip of the basket back to the chassis is about 36 to 38 feet, and you take another 8 foot for the chassis, and all of a sudden we took a tape measure to Main Street in their town, and they quickly realized that by the time they got this truck set up, this rear-mounted tower, for the 1- and 2- and 3-story tall rows of stores in their Main Street area, that the tower chassis would actually be in the store across the street. And they quickly determined that that probably wouldn't work for them. One of my better moments as far as consulting on apparatus, for sure, to prevent them from buying something that would have been almost unusable for a good portion of their town. Rear-mounted towers and are generally 3-section, and then mid-mounted towers are generally 4- or 5-section. And so those sections are shorter, and it makes for a better scrub area and less of an operational footprint to set the unit up. When we measure distance, the NFPA is clear and the manufacturers are clear of how they derive that number on the side of the aerial device, whether it's 100 foot or 105 foot or 75 foot or 95 foot or 93 foot, or in the case of today's discussion, we're talking about some new, rather larger ladders at 121 foot, 125 foot, or 137 foot, respectively. And that's just U.S. manufacturers, and they go up into the 200s with some aerial devices with European manufacturers overseas. But in any event, we have our aerial device that's measured at, say, 100 feet. Well, it's measured from the tip of the aerial back down to the ground. And we've already discerned here that most users in the U.S. fire market use their trucks in more of a horizontal plane than a vertical plane. And so the next measurement that we take on the truck at a 90-degree angle at 0-degree elevation is from the bottom beam of the ladder down to the ground. And one of the keys to this is, again, what salesmen may or may not say. A salesman may come in and tell our listeners, geez, you need to buy that 100-foot tower because you get 5 more feet over the mid-mounted tower. Well, that may be true if you're using it in a vertical plane. But when you use the apparatus in a horizontal plane, the reality is that the turntable on a rear-mounted apparatus has to sit higher off the ground and higher up in the chassis so that the basket and the and or the aerial can clear the cab. Versus a mid-mounted tower, which the chassis, the turntable is much lower in the chassis and has a less steep angle of departure, and hence that measurement from the bottom beam of the ladder down to the street is less. And in most that I've found, in most rear-mounted towers, that measurement from the bottom beam to the street is somewhere between 10 and 11 feet. And with a mid-mounted tower, that measurement is generally 6 or 7 feet. And so if you take a 95-foot tower and subtract 6 feet, you realize when you use a truck in a horizontal plane that you have 89 foot reach, at least to one side. If you take a rear-mounted tower and you do the same measuring and you subtract 10 feet from the 100 feet, and you realize that a rear-mounted tower has a nominal horizontal reach of 90 feet. And so the difference between a mid-mounted product and a rear-mounted product is within a foot. It's really negligible. The other point that is key here is that That reach, that horizontal reach, is only off one side of the truck. And so if you had a rear-mounted tower with a 90-foot reach, it's 90 foot on one side and 90 feet on the other for a total of 180 feet. Well, that would be true if you could take the turntable and put it right against the building line. But because we know of collapse potential and sidewalks and other things that we're not going to do that, generally the rule of thumb is to take one boom length away from the building line, and then you can operate from there. So our rear-mounted tower that we added up to be 180 feet, in reality, when you take the turntable away from the building line where it needs to be set up properly, it's probably going to have a horizontal reach of about 160 feet across a one-story building. The other thing with horizontal reach, as you go more into a vertical plane, you actually make a semicircle on the building itself. Again, as the farther you go up, you kind of have a half moon shape on the building, and you'll lose the two corners depending on how far you are or how close you are away from the building line. What do you think about those numbers and things that we've learned?
Well, like that being said, you know, people that have an existing aerial device tend, based on our experience, I think, to kind of understand the concept of horizontal reach. And when it comes time to replace the vehicle, they're replacing it for any one of a number of reasons. Sometimes it's because either the building setbacks or the character of the community has changed a little bit, and their device simply no longer fits the bill. I guess the best example of that would be a department that maybe formerly had a snorkel or some type of articulating device, that even the 85-foot snorkels had something less than 48 feet of horizontal reach. So while the device had great up and over capabilities, its ability to hit buildings that had setbacks was severely limited. Where I think sometimes departments, and that's why we're going through the discussion here, tend to miss the point of horizontal reach is for those departments that never had a device before, and as we've spoken at length at in the past, one of the most common devices is a 75-foot rear mount ladder in whatever kind of configuration you want, single axle or tandem axle. People buy that, and then unless they're educated consumers, they find that that the unit simply just doesn't have the capabilities to reach some of these buildings that have greater setbacks because of parking area mandated green spaces and so forth. So that's pretty important. Now, having said that, there has been a small but yet rather intense reinsurgence of people who are looking to purchase aerial devices that are standard high, that are higher than what maybe we've come to know over the period of years of units that at one point 100 feet was the practical limit of aerial devices, and now any number between 100 to like 110 feet, there's units that are built that have those types of vertical capabilities. But we're just going to briefly highlight three manufacturers that build devices that are significantly longer than those, and some of their stated, at least off published literature and some documentation that they have posted on their internet web pages of what the capabilities of those units are. I guess one that was most recently introduced at the International Association of Fire Chiefs Conference that recently concluded back in September in Chicago, Emergency One introduced their CR-137, which is a 137-foot vertical reach unit and somewhat of a reincarnation of a unit that they built for a number of years where they had built a 135-foot five-section all-aluminum aerial. Well, off the Emergency One website, they claim that the CR-137 model has a maximum horizontal reach of 127.5 feet, and that's with a tip load of 250 pounds. The unit operates with the E1 style underslung outriggers at a 13-foot 8-inch stance. And what was interesting is on their site, they noted several different tip loading capacities in the horizontal plane, Mike, at 250 pounds when it's out fully extended, and at the horizontal at 0 degrees when it's 127 and a half feet, a 500-pound tip load when the ladder was at the 110-foot mark, and a 750-pound tip load when the ladder would be retracted and extended to the 82-foot mark. So I thought that was kind of interesting that they were actually advertised three different tip loads, again, at the horizontal based on the amount of extension. The next higher device, or highest device, that we've been able to locate was a Schmiel fire apparatus out of Nebraska. Builds a 125-foot all-steel aerial device that has a 500-pound tip load. From some of the blueprints that they have up on their site, those units apparently can be built on a couple of different chassis, but in wheelbases, all tandem axles, obviously, in the 250 to 252-inch range. And again, depending on chassis and the travel height, you need to have a station that's got at least 14-foot doors, because the travel height on those units were between 11.9 to a little over 12 feet, as best as I could determine, with vehicles having an overall length of just under 47 feet. And on the Schmiel site, they advertise that that 125 ladder has a horizontal reach of 121 feet. Now, bearing in mind that the NFPA standard for measurement of horizontal reaches from the center line of the turntable to the outermost rung of the aerial. So again, it can be measured different ways, but the best thing, as Mike took us through, you want to make sure you get a good quality 100-foot tape. And if you're unsure as to what these building setbacks are, even if you're not in the market for a new ladder truck, that's the semblance of a good drill. Position your aerial in a lot of these target hazards where you're going to get the best position with, as Mike would say, the engine the heck out of the way and out of sight, and then take that tape and go from your center line of rotation over to the building and with the aerial and see what you can reach. And most importantly, it'll be pretty eye-opening, I'm sure, what you cannot reach. And the final device that we found that had a higher than somewhat standard aerial capabilities was built by KME, which they build a 121-foot aerial that, again, has a 500-pound tip load, and they advertise that their unit has a horizontal reach of 111 feet with the capability of having a elevation from minus 10 to plus 80 degrees at the maximum. Vehicle overall length on one of the units off their website was 44 feet 8 inches with a travel height of 12 foot 7 inches. So again, if you're planning any kind of aerial device, no matter what it is, you want to be measuring your bay in your station first before you get enthralled with anything, to make sure you've got enough space to safely back and maneuver the vehicle in, and then get a similar unit and tootle around town, as they say, to make sure this thing's going to go where you need it to be. And then once you get there, pay particular attention to the horizontal reach capabilities and make sure that you're going to buy something that's going to fit the need. So that being said, Mike, I understand as we wrap up today, you've got a couple of questions from listeners. What do we got?
Okay, Brother Tom. Have you ever heard or seen anything concerning Michelin tire failures on fire apparatus?
That's a good question. And we're not going to beat up and specifically, Michelin, because there's about two or three major brands of tires that are out there. We're not privy to any particular information with respect to failure of that brand of tire. But commonly, or more often, what happens is a department or several departments may have had handling issues with their apparatus with tires, be they Goodyear, Michelin, Continental, or whatever brand you're going to put on there. And the first thing we generally recommend to folks, if you've had issues, is to make sure that the vehicle, you have current vehicle weights on the unit, and then adjust the tire pressure in your tire to so that it matches the actual weight of the weight that you're carrying on the unit, being front or rear. A lot of times, Mike and I have gotten involved with people with complaining about poor handling characteristics on a tire, and one of the first things you find out is that the tire pressure, it's either severely underinflated or it has not been properly adjusted to match the actual weight that the vehicle is running around with up and down the street. That's not to say that you still could have some issues with respect to, and just about everybody has faced this at some point in time on some unit, sidewalls that seem to be a little bit not quite as stiff as you had on another version or type of tire, and that you find the unit has some unusual rolling characteristics, particularly when you're going around corners at what we want might consider normal speeds, but what other people might consider to be higher than normal or safe or prudent speeds. So if you continue to have issues, no matter who makes your tire, all of these folks have technical specialists that it might mean that you're going to have to, if you purchase the tires from a local tire vendor, no disrespect to them, but you might need to find out who their technical rep is and get those people in to come visit you in the station. They're more than happy to do that. They build, tire manufacturers like most component folks that supply us in the fire service. We're a small portion of their marketplace, but yet they're very attuned to what our needs are. And before you raise the white flag and surrender, you want to get these technical people in, explain the issue, have them go out and ride with you, check in to see what the issue is, and be able to address it as appropriately and professionally as possible. So that would be that one. Mike, you got anything else here before we wrap up for the day?
Well, just one other comment about that. I remember that I had asked you a question as it relates to handling and tires and weight. And one of the things that you had told me with the truck that I was working with is to take and weigh it one side of the apparatus and then compare that with the weight ticket to the other side of the apparatus. And what was the percentage of tolerance that was acceptable there before it became a problem?
You generally want to be within, 5 to no more than 7% off on the left side versus the right side of the vehicle. And again, this is more prevalent for departments that are operating rescue apparatus where you can have very different compartment loading, front to rear and side to side. It's also somewhat prevalent, Mike, as I've seen on a rescue pumper apparatus. It's interesting, if you look at the general evolution of rigs, back 10 or 15 years ago, a standard pumper had two horizontally hinged lift-up doors on the left side, and if you needed the ground ladders, you went to the right side of the apparatus, and 9 out of 10 times the ground ladders are there. Well, now 9 out of 10 times the ground ladders aren't there. They're buried somewhere inside the body through the tank on a hydraulic ladder rack, but the left side of the vehicle mirror images the right side of the vehicle in terms of the equipment carrying capacity or what the volume that you could put in there. Well, what happens a lot of times is over, maybe not initially, but over a period of years, the compartment loading, the equipment that you carry in the vehicle, changes up or you add, more often than not, we're adding additional stuff. And once you had a balanced piece of apparatus with respect to the compartment loading, now you don't. So the first thing you want to do is, again, before you run up the white flag and say, hey, I got problems and, this brand of tire, is no good. You probably want to be looking at the compartment loading and weigh the vehicles, as Mike mentioned, to make sure that you're somewhere within the tolerance level of where you need to be. And I guess the worst case example would be if you've got a walk-in or non-walk-in rescue vehicle, and on one side of the vehicle you got all of the fire suppression stuff, and on the other side you've got your shoring, all your hydraulic rescue tools, rescue jacks, struts, and you put your air cascade fill station on that side of the vehicle as well. No doubt in my mind, you're probably not within 5 to 7% of the side-to-side loading. So when you wonder why you have some roll in the body and the tires aren't performing the way you did, not a surprise that we kind of created that situation yourself. So We want to be cognizant of those kinds of things.
Oh, good job, Brother Tom, as always. You're right on the money. Our next question has to do with rims right around the tires. We seem to be on the same subject here. This listener, a fire commissioner from Long Island, New York, said, I took your class in Baltimore on maintenance and overweight apparatus, and you mentioned aluminum wheels over steel wheels. I would like to know where you got this information from. We just finished specking a new rear mount with steel wheels. I would like to change to aluminum, but I have opposition. Their argument is money. Your thoughts on that?
Okay. Well, there's a couple of different things. Aluminum wheels, you see almost 100% across the board on over-the-road, you know, Class A trucks delivering stuff, because they do inherently do a couple things. One, they're lighter in weight. So lighter in weight means those vehicles can carry more payload. We're not necessarily interested in that in the fire service. The other advantage that they have is that they dissipate heat more rapidly. So if you have a response area where you're on and off the brakes a lot, and in particular, if you have long runs, let's think about that that unit that we talked about. And again, aluminum rims didn't have anything to do with that incident. But in Kern County, California, I just know for a fact, because Mike and I have been out in that area, there are, you know, the ratio of ladder companies to engine companies in Kern County is not like it is in Prince George's County, Maryland, or FDNY, where it's 2-to-1 or 3-to-1. There's very few ladder companies, which means no different than where I recently came back, again, visiting out in Maui County, where there's two ladder companies on the main island. You got to believe those brothers have some long runs. So even if they get turned around en route and they have to return back, you got a 10, 15-mile, you know, return. If you're on and off the brakes, aluminum rims, without a doubt, will dissipate the heat better and provide you more increased, you know, braking capacity. Depending upon the manufacturer, and again, this is going to vary. If you deal with a manufacturer that builds a lot of fire trucks each year, or a chassis manufacturer, those people buy aluminum rims, you know, by the pallet load. They're not buying them, you know, one at a time, as compared to some small builder that, you know, his cost may vary. So again, this is, you know, you're not going to see everything is going to be equidistant here. But typically, if you take a department that was going to have steel rims, and people a lot of times did that from a cost consideration and for the fact, particularly if they had an outside tire shop or a tire vendor. I think Mike and I, we hit one of these people, I remember, down in the Fire Expo in Baltimore this past year. Somebody talked about the vendor that this county used for tires. I mean, they treated aluminum rims the same as steel rims, and they chew them up when they went to put new tires on the rims, and frankly, just weren't very careful. So a lot of people had the impression like, okay, for steel rims, you know, we can keep paint on those things. Now, you get in a situation where people say, well, I want it to look a little bit prettier, so I'm going to, you have to pay to get the rim painted by the manufacturer, and then you're going to put stainless steel wheel covers on there. Well, in a lot of cases, by the time you do a combination of those two things, you've come pretty close to the cost of purchasing the aluminum rims, you know, from the outset. So, you know, as a rule of thumb, you know, if you have a two-axle unit, aluminum rims, the upcharge on that could be somewhere between maybe $1,500 to $2,000 as a somewhat wide range. And on a tandem axle unit, could run you close to maybe $3,000. But again, if you were going to put, you know, wheel liners and stainless steel wheel covers on there, as compared to, you know, the cost of the aluminum rims, you've reduced the cost of that, you know, quite a bit. In general, you will see larger, and particularly, again, out on the West Coast where people have very long runs, not uncommon at all to see aluminum rims on everything in the fleet, from the smallest pumper, you know, up to the larger water tenders and aerial devices. Again, you can't take these numbers and say, you know, well, Tom and Mike said it should be this. It's going to vary depending upon the manufacturer and frankly, what, you know, where you are in the process. If, for example, you bid your vehicle out with steel rims and you're at the point of the pre-construction engineering conference, and you decide you want to, you know, add aluminum rims, then chances are that cost is going to be a little bit more than if a suggestion would be, if you're unsure or your group is split as to which way to go, bid the standard, quote, steel rims and put an option in your bid so that people can identify what the cost of those aluminum rims are, and you'll know what the upcharge is, you know, right at the get-go. I mean, if chances are the cost of them at the checkout counter at that point potentially could be a little bit less than if you try to do it a little bit later on in the process. So, you know, hopefully those things will help some of our folks and our listeners. And Mike, before we wrap up here, any parting thoughts for the day?
Yeah, I think next month, Tom, we may be in a position to make a big announcement as it relates to the FDNY and more of a cultural shift in the way that we drive and operate fire apparatus. So I want our viewers, or our listeners rather, to stay tuned for that. And for next month, we're working on a program that's going to involve the new green biodiesel fuel as it relates to the potential to gum up the works in diesel engines, and we are in the process of researching that, Tom and I, and we are going to come back to you, our loyal listeners, with an update on that fuel source and what it's doing to fuel tanks and fuel systems going forward.
All right. Well, Mike, it's as always, we have Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, the apparatus architects. Any of our listeners that would like to have a question sent in that they'd like to have us respond to on the air, or just a couple of ways you can get a hold of us, you can send your questions in the podcast at firehouse.com. You can stop in at any time and visit our website, emergencyvehiclerespondents.com. You'll see a great picture of Brother Mike sitting on the front of, oh my God, it's a ladder truck. There's a contact form there. You can get a hold of us at any point. So for Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, the apparatus architects, until the next time, be careful and be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.